Blah, 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 blah.
Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah.
The CMU Podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, SFX, RIAA, PRS, PPL, and RITAORA. It's the CMU Podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. Chris Cook is here, the business editor of CMU. And we're going to talk about lots of letters, according to that intro.
Is that your new way of defining the podcast at the start of the edition when podcast rules say that you must?
Well, it's lots of acronyms, and then I felt I had to spell Rita Ora, or it would just look weird.
You were very shouty.
If anyone hadn't noticed that I spelled out Rita Ora.
You had a very shouty start of the podcast there. I don't know if my headphones were on particularly loud this week, but I felt that you were shouting both the this week bit and then the hello bit.
It was just annoyance at the number of takes that took.
There were quite a lot of letters in that. I can't even say it. If SFX and the RIAA.
RIAA is really hard to say. I've noted that before, but like in amongst a lot of.
Do some people
letters,
say RIAA?
Yeah, they do, but I hate those people.
You hate those people.
Yeah.
Every single one of them.
I wish bad things upon them.
Have you never met anybody who says RIAA that you like?
I can only think of one person. Who said it?
Oh, who said it? Who you like. PRS, PPL. And yeah, if they were all to merge, that would be a lot of letters, wouldn't it?
See, the PRS, normally I wouldn't have to say 5 things in the intro, but PRS and PPL haven't named their joint venture. We'll get onto that.
Yeah, but you chose not to say the and, because if you'd said PRS and
Well, then there would
PPL,
have been two ands.
Which is what was in the script. Then
PRS and PPL and Rita Ora just wouldn't work.
Well, you could put an Oxford comma in. In fact, you have put an Oxford comma.
Well, how? that doesn't work in audio format.
Well, you could say SFX, RIAA, PRS and PPL, Oxford comma, and Rita Ora. That would have worked much better.
No, it needs
fact,
to be snappy.
I think that Matt
Quick
should
and
take...
snappy, that is what this podcast is all about.
Matt should take what I've just said and replace it with what you said at the start.
No, you don't get to do the intro.
At least you're not making any claims about how long this podcast is going to be.
No,
week.
Because... someone thought it would be hilarious if it was over an hour last week.
After you...
when I'm not sure there was enough content for it.
You introed last week's podcast. For those of you who either don't remember... Oh, I think that bottle makes noise. Andy Malt just took a little swig from his bottle of odd-looking drink, which I haven't bought. We're not reviving the old Chris Brings Andy a revolting
drink. It's just a grape drink.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
It's very odd-looking and quite noisy. But anyway, you carry on drinking your noisy, odd-looking grape drink. What was I saying
then? I don't even know.
I know what I was saying. I was explaining that at the start of last week's podcast, you came up with this snappy slogan, which was something along the lines of music business chat for an hour or your money back.
In under an hour.
That was the key point, wasn't it? Under an hour or your money back.
Yes.
And then it ended up that the podcast was like 1 hour, 7 seconds.
I know. So if you're new to the podcast... this week, unfortunately, you missed out on the refunds that went out to every listener last week.
Yes, every penny spent by our listeners on last week's podcast, I personally refunded. I did that after the podcast went out. But we're making no claims. We can't afford. I mean, if we were to make that mistake again, we'd probably go out of business. So no specific commitments on time lengths this week. Andy Malt did say, before we started recording, the thing that usually results in an incredibly long podcast... he said the big line, I'm not sure there's much to say about any of this week. And whenever you say that about the stories that we've selected, it turns out we have a lot to say.
Well, yes, because then you delayed us further by telling me all the things you had to say instead of waiting.
The podcast then ends up being a 4-hour epic. So we'll see how long this podcast goes. But what we will do is cover all the big developments in the music industry this week and explain and digest and discuss and analyse and comment and embellish. That's what we're going to do this week. Quite a lot of embellishing, I think, given Andy hasn't got anything to say about any of this week's stories.
Oh, I normally find that I do have things to say.
Well, we'll see, won't we? We'll see.
Yeah, so we'd better do that. Let's get on to a story we've been teasing for months now. It seems like every week in the What We Didn't Have Time to Talk About section, we'd have a little mention of SFX. And now look at it. Every now and then we'd say, we're going to talk about that soon. And here it is.
In the
gone
top
bankrupt.
Slot. It is in the headline big story of the week
because
slot.
Finally, it's... curled up and died.
This has been a very long time coming. Such a long time coming I can't even remember what we've talked about this on the podcast before.
Everything.
Because other than the little mentions in the what we haven't talked about slot, I'm pretty sure we gave a bit more information about the whole SFX story when it was first starting to fall off a cliff last July, August, really, is when things kicked off. But actually, this story's been running for about a year now. So SFX, this is a V2 SFX, let's remember. So the original SFX, a company set up by Robert F.X. Silliman. So somewhere from that name comes the S and the F. And the X.
FX Silliman, probably.
So the original SFX was set up in the 90s. It was a venue business. It grew through a rampant acquisition. And ultimately, it was sold to Clear Channel. And then they spun it off and it became what is now known as Live Nation. So in some ways, Robert FX Silliman was responsible for the business that is now Live Nation. He then set up another company that had a silly name. I can't even remember what that was. I think there was an X in it. But it wasn't SFX. I can't remember. Anyway, he set up another company and it bought American Idol and he bought the Elvis Presley estate. So he took a slice of the Elvis Presley estate and built a sort of media brand licensing business that he then sold for a lot of money. And this was his third big business enterprise. And what Bob Silliman noticed about 4 years ago is that dance music, that's what it's all about in 2011 or whenever it was, when he was considering his new business. I'm going to do dance music, he said.
EDM, that's where it's at.
EDM is what it's all about. And so SFX version 2, or version 3, I suppose, was launched. And as with his previous businesses, as soon as it was live, he started buying up basically every single dance
music
festival in the world. There are no dance music festivals left that are not owned in some way by SFX. Well, that's a slight exaggeration, but he bought a lot.
Yes.
So big dance music festivals. He also bought Beatport, the dance music download store slash streaming platform.
Well, latterly streaming service under SFX's guidance.
Yes, it was a profitable download store previously, and now it's a presumably massively loss-making streaming service because all streaming services are massively loss-making. So who bought Beatport and some other related companies? There was a ticketing company and a marketing company and some other bits and pieces, and that was SFX V2. And then he floated it in 2013.
Yep.
So
and it did quite well.
It did quite well on whichever stock exchange it was, Nasdaq, I think. It floated on. And so, made a load more money through the flotation, continued to buy companies with some of the cash that came in through the flotation. And all seemed to be going fine. It was the great new SFX. It was all about dance music. It was all about EDM coming of age and taking over the world.
Some people said there was an EDM bubble.
Yes.
But Robert Silliman said no. This is it now.
And those pessimists not only said there was an EDM bubble, but they insisted it was a bubble that would burst. Mm. Do all bubbles burst eventually?
Yes.
Okay, well, in which case I didn't need to state that.
No.
So people were saying this bubble has to burst. Also, some people felt that, brand partnerships seem to be a big part of the strategy. We're going to do brand partnerships because that's how brands are going to reach the kids through dance music. And I think some people felt from the start he was slightly over-egging just how much potential there was for the brand partnership side of this business. Anyway, 2015 was not a great year for SFX, I think it is fair to say.
No, because he decided, having floated it on the stock exchange, Robert Silliman decided that actually he quite fancied having it all back for himself.
So this was about a year ago. So this is why this particular chapter of the SFX story has now been running for about a year. So you're right, last February he said, I'm buying it back. And it's like, well, you've only just floated it and made a lot of money. And now you want it back. And it's sort of like, well, why? Why do you want it back? Now, sometimes when entrepreneurial, maverick business people, particularly entertainment business people, float their companies, having been very much in control when it was a private company previously, they don't like the scrutiny that comes with being a Wall Street listed company, where suddenly all of these analysts and investors and bankers have an interest in your business and you have to be careful what you say, otherwise people get nervous and then your share price goes down. And lots of the more maverick people in the entertainment industry don't really like that thing. And I think it's fair to say that Robert F.X. Silliman is a bit of a maverick.
Yeah, and quite outspoken and prone to say things that that possibly annoy people.
And so it may well just be that he's done the whole listed company thing. He's had the scrutiny. He's done those tortuous investor calls where they all shout at you. And he just doesn't want to be part of that anymore.
Some people would say, right, that's it. I'm selling the company. But he believed so much that EDM is the future. He was like, no, I'm keeping this.
And he was still the majority shareholder, I think. Yeah. So they didn't, even though they floated the company, he was still the single biggest shareholder. And I think he had more than 50% of the company, or maybe I'm getting that wrong. Anyway, he was a significant shareholder in the company still. And his plan was, I'm going to buy it back. Now, some cynics at the time said, well, is this about Silliman trying to take control and not have to sort of justify his business and what he's doing to all of these investors and analysts and all of that? Or is this an attempt to cover up the fact that the company's not doing very well? And obviously, when you're a publicly listed company, four times a year, you have to put out your full accounts. You have to be incredibly transparent about how the business is going. Whereas, once you're a private company, you still have to share your accounts with various different authorities. But your finances are not scrutinized in the way they are when you're publicly listed. So was one of the motivations that things weren't going quite as well as he had hoped. And so if he could put it back into private ownership with just a small number of investors with whom he had quite a close relationship, then there wouldn't be the public glare on the challenges in this business. Whichever it was, 2015 was a tricky year. Various things happened. The financials of the business were struggling, and all of this resulted in the share price. I mean, we like to say share prices have tanked, because I like the word tanked. It sounds quite dramatic, doesn't it? But the SFX share price really tanked.
Well, let's
in 2015. There,
at the point at which Robert Silliman proposed his first buyback plan, because there were two, he was offering $5.25 per share.
Yeah, so I think initially he offered
quite a generous offer.
Yeah, I think he offered $4.75 initially, which was already a dollar or something over the listed share price at the time. The shareholders were like, we don't like this idea to start with. You're going to have to offer us more. And so you're right. It then went up to $5.25.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, while those negotiations were going on, the actual share price on Wall Street started to go down, 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 down. Until, what was it? What was the lowest point about 2 weeks ago?
It got to about 6 cents.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been that again this week.
So we're talking cents instead of dollars.
Yeah.
So the $5.25 was a very, very generous offer.
If you have confidence in the future of this company, now is the time to buy.
So, share price tanked. The company had significant debts, at least $300 million in debts. And obviously, when you're a publicly listed company, when your share price tanks, your valuation goes down, because listed companies have something nearing a more genuine valuation in that how much would it cost to buy all the shares tomorrow? Market capitalization, as they call it. So the market cap of the company also tanked. And often, your ability to borrow money is linked to the valuation of your company. So when your company goes from being quite valuable to basically being worth nothing, that then makes those $300 million in debts a problem. And so you said that there were two attempts to buy back from Silliman. So the first attempt, basically, it turned out that he didn't have enough money at $5.25 a share.
Yeah, it all looked like it was going ahead. And then suddenly the company said, just want to check you do have that amount of money. And he had to go, no.
I mean, to be fair, at the start of that process, he was clearly hoping to bring in some other investors and backers.
Yes, but then when the share price dropped, the other investors wisely said, yeah, and maybe not so much.
So I think it was August that eventually Silliman had to say, yeah, don't have the money, that's all off. And at that point, the SFX board, obviously Robert Silliman is on the board as the CEO and founder of the company, but they set up a separate committee of independent directors. And they said, right, we're going to take any offers for the business. So Robert Silliman can put in a new offer. Okay, we understand he can't offer $5.25 a share anymore, but we'll allow him to put in a second offer. But while he is putting in an offer, if anyone else wants this company, if anyone else wants this business, will it consider your offers too? And so then we had another 2 or 3 months of, some people have approached to buy the company. Although, as we understand it, there was some interest in part of the company, i.e. buying some of the festivals that SFX had hoovered up, but nobody other than Silliman was interested in taking the entire business as a going concern. So Silliman came forward with another offer, which was similar to his first offer, except he was not being anywhere near as generous. It was nowhere near $5.25 a share. It was still incredibly generous given what the share price was at the time, but it was a much more conservative offer. But then in November, he withdrew that offer too, partly because the share price was continuing to tank. So even at his lower offer,
it looked a bit,
it was still
over the top.
Too over the top. Also, some quarterly figures came out for SFX for probably its most important quarter, which included all of the big summer festivals. And those weren't as impressive as people had been hoping. So he said, now is not the time for buyback number two, even at the lower rate that I was now offering. And so by the end of 2015, the future of SFX was looking Well, people have been talking about bankruptcy for quite a long time by this point. What was the future of SFX? There was talk of various bankers being hired to look at the options, to look at the debt pile, to see if they could sell some assets off. James Barton, who was the founder of Cream and Creamfields, who is sort of head of dance music or some similar job title at Live Nation, because Live Nation bought the Cream Festival, was rumoured to be close to being headhunted to take over as CEO of SFX. So Silliman would take a back seat and he would come in and try and rescue the business. But then that didn't happen. And then last month, as 2016 began, it was officially announced that they had brought in some consultants, some restructuring consultants, which was basically a last-ditch attempt to save this business.
And that always suggests bankruptcy.
And this, well, and indeed, the consultants who were brought in said, OK, these are the different things that were going to be considered in order to restructure this business, to rescue this business. And, oh, look, one of the things on the list that we're considering is putting the company in... into bankruptcy. And lo and behold, this week, finally, the SFX parent company applied for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, which is an American thing.
Yeah, so that finally happened. Robert Silliman also stepping down as CEO. He's now chairman of the company, and they're seeking a new CEO who might want to take forward this definitely going to be successful again business. Robert Silliman is very positive about the future, like weirdly over the top positive in his statement. Where they were talking about how they'd done a deal to... They've written off $300 million of debt.
Which is quite an achievement.
That's quite an achievement.
And basically the plan from the... during the Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection period is that... Well, an ad hoc group they referred to.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a technical term.
That sounds so flaky.
An ad hoc group of SFX's money lenders, so some of the people owed some of that $300 million, I think basically have agreed to turn their debt into equity. So the company will cease to be a listed company, it will become a private company again, and the people who are owed that money will have a significant equity share in the new business, which will then continue to own all of the various subsidiaries around the world and all of the different festivals. So, yeah, Silliman was hopeful. Well, he was saying the fact that they have done this, the fact they've agreed to do this, shows that they're confident.
Yes, they're confident, as am I, in the future of this great company that will rise again. It's worse to that effect.
It was possibly a... Well, I suppose, you know, they could have forced the sell-off of the festivals and hoped to get some of their money back. So I suppose there was another option, but you don't know how much of this is just a sort of cutting your losses and it's like, yeah, that's that. that's the better of various evils.
But what's actually happening to its brands? That's the thing. Beatport was very quick with a statement to say, well, having previously had some issues with paying rights holders
that was the second buyback, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so when the money was frozen at some point and
that was all very confusing. Yeah. So it was during, I can't remember which stage in the story was, but it was after Silliman had called off his first buyback. And I think it was when they were considering his second bid. And then suddenly Beatport told all their labels, oh, while all of this is going through the motions, we can't pay anybody. And then there was a bit of a hoo-ha online and people were like, what do you mean you can't pay
yeah.
anybody?
And then Robert Silliman came out and went, oh, it's all right. No,
that was a mistake.
Sorry.
Don't know what they're talking about.
Money, have it.
Yeah. So this time Beatport were very keen to say, that ain't happening this time.
You're still going to get paid. Don't worry. We're all fine. It's business as usual. That's what they said.
Meanwhile, the promoters of one of the probably the most famous of the festivals that are within the SFX group, although it is, but it isn't within the SFX group. So the promoters of Tomorrowland in Belgium.
Yeah. Well, Tomorrow World is SFX's big US festival, which comes out of Tomorrowland in Belgium. And they've also got Tomorrowland Brazil, which is associated through the deal. But there, Tomorrowland's statement was interesting. I think the organisers of that are at a remove from SFX because their association with the company came through another acquisition. So ID&T was a promoter in the Netherlands.
Which owned half of Tomorrowland.
Which owned half of Tomorrowland. SFX took a 75% stake in that.
So do the maths.
Do the math. And then...
Well, you don't need to do the maths. Because afterwards...
Well, afterwards. So that would technically have got the 50% on board. But Tomorrowland's founder said, actually, we'd like to buy your 50% stake back and we'll take Tomorrowland independent again.
So Tomorrowland itself is not part of the SFX group and they were very keen to remind everybody of that this week as SFX went into bankruptcy.
But they did still have an association with SFX on these new festivals that they were going to launch in the US initially and then another one in Brazil. They said the Brazilian and the Belgian festivals will go ahead as planned. The dates were already in the diary. That's all fine. However, Tomorrow World, which is a September festival... They currently don't know. It's too far off.
Beyond the financial issues, there were some logistical problems with Tomorrow World in 2015, which added to the problems just when SFX was going through its particularly rocky period and Silliman Buyback 2 was under consideration.
Yeah, it really needed a festival to go ahead where they could go, but look how good our festivals are.
Whereas it was a bit of a washout festival and there were lots of logistical problems because of the weather, and that sort of added to the bad press. So that, there are probably already reasons why Tomorrow World 2016 was hanging in the balance beyond SFX. And as you say, of all the things in which the Tomorrowland guys are involved, you sense the US one was in essence a franchise. It was that they said, took the Tomorrowland thing and they sort of reinvented it for America.
Yeah, because their statement very much said, we foresee a future for a US festival, but we're sort of saying, not sure if that's with SFX. And it was interesting, because they're at a remove from the company, they can be a bit more open, perhaps, than other brands under the SFX umbrella. So basically said, yeah, we did this US festival with them. And it turns out that our goals are not really the same as theirs, because presumably SFX's goals are make lots of money through brand partnerships.
Yes. So, suggesting that there may have already been a few tensions between them and their business partners on the international versions of their events. So, as I say, the official SFX line is, this is good news. We've sorted out all this mess. Just allow us go through the Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
This is what we wanted all along. They'll be so happy.
Well, I suppose on one level, Silliman will have a privately owned SFX at the end of all this, as far as I can see. What stake he will have in that, I do not know. But the hope is that SFX, the parent company, will be rescued. It will then not have all of those debt liabilities that it used to have. And then all of the other businesses underneath can then get on with doing what they do. And hopefully the EDM bubble hasn't burst so much that those companies do have a future once cut free from the 300 million debts of the parent company. So we'll see, I guess. But finally, a decent dramatic development in a very, very long running story that could have. I mean, they do own so many of the dance music festivals now. And I know there was an article, wasn't there? Was it last year or maybe the year before, saying that actually SFX pumping money into the festivals that it had taken over had an impact on the wider dance music community, in that it allowed the agents of the superstar producers and DJs to really ramp up the fees they were earning, that then had an impact on every dance music festival in the world. So it'll be interesting to see whether, beyond what happens with SFX and the festivals it owns, whether it has any ramifications on the wider EDM community. We'll see, I guess.
The RIAA now, and it's Gold and Platinum Awards for record sales.
So what's happened with them?
Well, you know how I said they're Gold and Platinum Awards for record sales?
You did, I heard you.
They're now Gold and Platinum Awards for record sales and streaming numbers.
So the RI, I can't decide what to say now. The Recording Industry.
Single A, single A.
The Recording Industry Association of America has this week announced that streaming stats are going to be included in the maths that it does in order to award its gold and platinum records to recognise the best-selling, most popular, successful thingies. Now, the BPI here in the UK, who also dish out gold and platinum discs,
the BP Single Eye.
The BP Single Eye started doing this last year, didn't they? They started putting streams into single awards, so the gold and platinum for singles, a couple of years ago, maybe even 3 years ago. Basically, the BPI have done it whenever the chart's done it. So in this country, when the chart decides, right, we're adding streams into the mix, and that happened with the singles chart quite a bit before it happened to the albums chart, the BPI almost immediately said, well, if the charts are going to have streams, we'll count streams in the gold and platinum awards as well. And whatever system the chart are using, we'll apply that to our awards too. Whereas in the US, there has been a little bit of a disconnect between what's happening over here in the charts and what is happening over here in the trade bodies' sales awards.
Yes. And as you say, sales awards. So when you put streaming into these things, as happens with the charts, you have to work out how many streams equal one record sale.
And it's interesting, as more countries have added streaming data into their charts, so rather than having a standalone streaming chart, which is what most countries start with as streaming starts to take off, as each country decides, okay, we're going to include streaming data in with the CD sales and with the download sales, They've all done it a different way, haven't they? Yeah. So in every country, it's all worked out differently. So Germany added streaming stats to its albums chart this week, and they're doing it in a really complicated way. But in terms of the US for this, it's actually quite simple, but in some quarters, it's been quite controversial.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because in the UK, it's weighted so that it's a set number of streams equal an album sale. However, it can't just be the three singles off the album. They're kind of given a different weighting depending on whether they're album tracks or singles.
Yeah, and that all comes from the problem with streams. Whereas when you're adding download data in, well, that's quite straightforward because download sales
it's just a sale.
Are quite like CD sales. So either you download the single or you download the album. Whereas with streaming, very few people go into the streaming platform. Well, perhaps some people do. Do you go into streaming platforms and just pick an album and play it in full?
Yes.
All right, then. At least one person
multiple
does that.
Multiple times a day.
But the consensus is a significant portion of people who use streaming services don't listen to full albums. So it's not that you can say, OK, that's an album play. You listen to those 10 tracks in the order that God or maybe the artist intended, and therefore that now counts as a listen to the album. People listen to the tracks in whatever order they listen to them. So therefore, you need to be a little bit more flexible. Having said that, as you say, this weighting exists so that if there's one massive hit single that is listened to a huge amount of times...
But no one listens to any of the other tracks.
All the other album tracks are fillers and nobody's interested. That can't skew the figures. It makes it look like, in terms of streams, this album has had massive consumption when actually, no, it hasn't. It was just one big hit and the rest of the album no one's listening to. So these complicated ways to try and overcome that problem that the UK chart and therefore the BPI are using.
Yes, but in the US, as far as we can see, there isn't such a complicated calculation and they're just going with 1,500 streams, an on-demand track or video equals one album sale.
And that's because with the equivalent for singles in the US, where they added streaming data in a few years ago, it was 100 streams equal the download, wasn't it? And now they've changed it to be 150 streams equals a download.
Yeah.
The assumption is every album has 10 tracks, obviously. So if it's 150 streams equals a track download, then obviously 1,500 streams equals an album sale. And that's how we're going to do it.
Good. That's sorted. Everyone's happy.
Let's announce a whole load of albums that have just gone platinum because of the crazy new maths that we are doing. So in some quarters, this has been quite controversial for various reasons. First of all, some are saying that's way too low. 1,500 streams, that can't possibly equal an album sale. The other thing is, unlike here in the UK, so we, as well as the slightly complicated system that we explained earlier that applies here in the UK, also, it doesn't apply to YouTube in the UK. So Spotify return, Deezer return, Apple Music return, Google Play, blah, blah returns, Tidal returns. But YouTube plays aren't counted for either the chart or the sales awards in the UK. Whereas in the US, the Billboard 100, which is the main singles chart in the US, has had YouTube streams in it for quite some time now, because that all happened the year when that Harlem Shake was a thing. Because I remember it being every time one of those silly Harlem Shake videos got played, it was counting towards the Billboard 100. So YouTube has been in the singles chart in the US for a while. And the YouTube stats are being applied to these sales awards too. So the thing that people were talking about is how can 1,500 plays on YouTube equate to an album sale? So in some quarters, just the maths has been controversial, and particularly because YouTube is part of this as well as the paid-for streaming services.
Yeah, and because the benchmarks for the awards haven't changed. So gold is still 500,000 sales, platinum still 1 million sales.
But with the 1,500 equal sale thing.
But this new streaming calculation added in, you could technically have a platinum album without actually selling any copies of your album and just having a really popular track on YouTube.
And ultimately, they are both about telling us how successful a certain track or a certain album has been. Although, how are we defining success? Because actually, when you think about the chart, even back in the old day when the chart was just CD sales, so before they added in downloads or certainly before they added in streams, actually being number one in the chart didn't tell you anything about how many records had been sold. All it told you was that that record sold more than any other record in that week.
Yeah, because, I mean, especially, yeah, labels still, particularly major labels, still take the chart as a guide of how well they're doing. But like you say, some weeks you get to number one because no one bought any records that week.
Yeah, and I mean, it's no secret that some number one records will have sold over 100,000 units in the UK to go number one, and others will have sold 25,000 units.
Or less, wasn't it, when we had 19,000?
Yeah, there was a period where you could get there hardly selling any records. And so, actually, in terms of how many copies you've sold, the chart's not telling us anything. All it's telling us is, well, you were were the most popular record this week. And we know there are busy release weeks and there are quiet release weeks. Just after Christmas, usually, is a really quiet release time. And so it's much easier to get to number one in both the singles chart and the album chart. And actually, in some ways, in streaming, the charts, you could argue, are a more accurate representation of actual financial performance, in that ultimately, the streaming services are revenue share businesses. So the relationship between the record companies and a Spotify is a revenue share arrangement. And how much you earn in any one month is based on consumption share rather than how many times your record or your album was streamed in any one month. Now, at the moment, quite a lot of streaming services are paying minimum per play fees. And while that is still part of the business, then there is an element of how many times you were streamed is relevant. But once ultimately the streaming services gain critical mass and it all becomes about revenue share and consumption share, which is where it will ultimately head, once you get to that point, how many times you were streamed in any one month is irrelevant. What matters is how many times were you streamed compared to everybody else, because that is how it is decided how much money you earn. So that's how streaming works. So in that world, actually, the chart suddenly makes more sense, because it's not about how many records you sold. It's about how many records you sold in comparison to everybody else. That is how revenue is calculated, and that is how the chart is calculated. So actually, in streaming, the chart makes more sense than it ever did in the CD day. Although one thing, Mark Mulligan wrote an article about this, and he was quite critical about this plan, and I also was referencing your point that the labels use the charts and the gold platinum thing as a way of measuring their success. And he was saying, well, as the streaming data goes in and sort of fudges it all, that's a bad thing to do. But it was mad to use those as a measure of success to start with. And arguably, actually, in the streaming domain, finally, the charts are sort of a measure of your financial success. Although Mark Mulligan's other point is valid, which is mixing up physical and download sales with streaming data actually confuses everything, so that the charts or the awards you get at the end of it are sort of meaningless. And perhaps, although it's, as the RIAA would say, is, well, we've got to embrace the new, it's a new age, we need to put streaming into the sales awards, is there an argument for saying, well, actually, these are two very different businesses, we should have one chart and one set of awards for sales, where it's physical or download, and then separate charts and separate awards for how you're doing on the streaming services. But I mean, even the gold platinum stuff, okay, that is based traditionally on units sold, but how much it tells you about the financial performance of the record is debatable, because in the olden days of CDs, some albums would be $6.99 in our price and some albums would be $16.99, yeah, depending on how much the label was taking a hit on the profit margin in order to build market share or to get hype going for an artist. So even then, if there's a $6.99, $16.99 price difference on a million units, that's a lot of money difference.
So what you're saying is, at the end of every week, every label should have to report exactly how much they've earned on every album and single.
Well, what I am saying is, ultimately, the charts and the gold platinum stuff was always a bit of an ego thing anyway. And
well, yeah,
what record companies should be focusing on, they don't need to tell me what financial performance they did, but internally within the label, that is definitely what they should be focusing on.
If it was about a cold measure of success, then they wouldn't need to give out framed platinum discs. I think that sort of suggests it's more about ego.
And to be fair, it's a PR thing. I mean, it gets PR coverage for music and the music industry every week.
Because you can say now that Michael Jackson's Thriller is 32 times platinum. What does that even mean?
They couldn't think of some
surely there's
mineral,
another metal.
that is 32 times as value as platinum. So anyway, streaming has been added to the gold and platinum record sales thingies in America. And whether or not that means you no longer take those seriously, well, that's up to you to decide. But I would argue that you should never have taken charts or gold and platinum discs too seriously to start with. They're all just stats nonsense. And people like stats nonsense.
They do.
But it doesn't really tell you how you as a label and an artist are doing financially. And ultimately, that's what matters. So look at your bank statements, basically. Forget the charts. Forget nice gold discs on the wall. Just get your bank statements out.
Sit down and think, are we all having a nice time? And if you are, then well done. You've done a good job.
And if when you look at your bank statements, actually, despite the good chart position and the gold disc on the wall, things aren't looking so good, on the upside, remember what Robert Zillerman says. Company goes bankrupt with $300 million in debt. Everything's great. So take that as your guidance and everyone will be happy. As predicted, this is turning out to be quite a long podcast, although there have been quite a few screw-ups. So by the time Matt does his clever edits...
People don't know that.
It might end up being...
It sounds seamless.
It might end up being a 10-minute podcast.
People think we're very good at this.
So we'll see. So let's do a quite quick, but not too quick, run-through this week's CMU Approved.
A just right run-through.
So that... If this is
like
a long
Goldilocks and the Three Bears, so if this reviewing is a long music.
If this is a long podcast, it's not too long. But then, if it turns out actually this is a very short podcast, we have some substance. So let's quickly go through the
yes,
acts,
very quickly. Let's not make this bit waffly.
The tracks, the artists that you have been approving in the CMU Daily this week, starting with Sin Sandon. Is that how you're saying that?
No.
How you
saying
it?
Sinner Sandon.
Is that how you're saying it?
I think Sinner. I didn't actually look it up, but Sinner, I think, let's go with that.
Go on.
Anyway, she has just released her third album. It's called In Between Sparks. I put a couple of tracks in, but the one I'm just going to mention is Sweet Electricity, because that is the best one on the album. Very electronic pop track. Like, it relies on, it's quite sweet, but relies on a tension underneath it to make it interesting. Well worth a listen.
Beyoncé's mate Sophie Beam next.
I don't know if they're mates, but Sophie Beam is indeed signed to Beyoncé's management company, Parkwood Entertainment.
I'm a mate with everyone I work with.
No, that's not true. Sophie Beam. She first appeared age 13 on The X Factor in America, and she seems to have survived that to return 3 years later with her debut single, with Beyoncé as her manager. And sounding good. She's switched. She used to have more of a kind of folky pop sound, and now they've turned her into a more slick R&B artist, which is what should happen to all artists.
Well, certainly this artist. So Skyline is the track that you are recommending.
That's right. It's their only one.
Oh, well.
So
that was why you picked it.
Yeah.
But it's still worth listening.
It wasn't a tough choice.
Still worth listening.
It's really good.
Guns.
Guns.
You're approving Guns, the musician. You're not approving Guns.
I don't approve Guns.
Not, this
apologies
is not seeing you
officially
saying everyone get a gun.
No, I'm approving I Know Exactly How It Feels by Guns, who is a musician from Norway. And this is her second single. It's of note because it's just been released in the US by development label Plus One, which suggests she's being set up for great things. I hope so, because she is very good.
So go check that out. And finally, Rina. Now, how the hell do you say this?
This is so easy. I can't believe you got it.
Soeyama.
Rina Soeyama.
Yeah.
She's got her third single out. She's been releasing music since 2013, but not very prolifically. So just four tracks out there in the world. This one is a cover.
Was one a B-side, if this is
one was a B-side,
single.
Yeah.
I just undid the maths there.
Well, one was a B-side, one I don't think was officially released.
Oh, so two.
She's not doing very well. But she's very good. This track is a rework of a Michael Jackson song. Do you know the Michael Jackson song, I Wanna Be Where You Are?
Of course.
Yes, from his 1972 debut
solo
album.
I remember. I was there.
She has reworked it, She's retitled it.
I'm here.
I know.
Yeah. Excited about this cover. Tell me more.
She's retitled it Where You Are. She's made it sort of an assessment of love in the digital age, which obviously Michael Jackson's original 1972 song was not about. But that's all updated and good, and you should check her out.
And you were saying that if you didn't know it was a Michael Jackson cover, you would not be aware it was a Michael Jackson cover.
No, partly because it's a Michael Jackson song that I don't think many people know.
So forget that and just go and listen to it as if it was an original piece of work.
Yeah.
So CMU Approved tracks this week, completemusicupdate.com/approved.
PRS and PPL together have this week announced a new joint venture which will provide a single license on performing rights.
Yes, so the PRS, the Performing Right Society, and PPL, the Phonographic Performance Limited, the doesn't work there, does it?
No, but whatever, carry on, people won't notice.
Have announced that they are going to collaborate on a new joint venture business to offer these single licenses for performing rights, specifically for public performance. So PPL, PRS are the collecting societies of the music publishers and the record industry respectively. So when the music industry decides to license collectively rather than directly, PRS represents songwriters and music publishers, and PPL represents record companies and recording artists. So if you are a radio station who needs licenses from music companies in order to cover the copyright in the recordings that you're going to play, you go and get one license from PRS to cover the copyright in the songs, you're going to get another license from PPL to cover the copyright in the recordings, and then you can play any records, any songs in the repertoire of the two collecting societies, and you don't have to go to every label and every publisher to do separate deals. You're basically covered on a blanket license. You pay a bit of money to PRS, you pay a bit of money to PPL, and all is fine. And the same applies to clubs and bars and cafes and restaurants and any workplace that plays music in a public space. You need a license under copyright law, but you don't have to go to every single record company, every single publisher. The collective licensing system has it covered, and you go and get a deal from PPL and you go and get a deal from PRS. So on one level, that's simpler for everybody. It's simpler for the licensee because they only need to get two licenses. It's simpler for the rights owners and the artists and the songwriters because they don't have to do lots of different deals, and the money just flows in.
The problem is, of course, that people don't really understand the music industry. So someone who is already annoyed by the fact that they have to get a license to play the radio in their shop is then doubly annoyed because they pay one person and then someone else comes along and says, oh, you owe us money as well. And like, what? I already paid for music to be in my shop for reasons I don't understand, and now I have to pay again. What the hell's going on? So really, it's sort of weird that this joint license didn't already exist to stop people complaining.
Yes, and even those licensees who understand that there are two separate copyrights in music, there is one copyright in the song and there is one copyright in the recording, even they would say, well, the whole point of collective licensing is to simplify the process and reduce the number of deals that we have to do. That's why, as far as we are concerned on the licensee side, that's the attraction of collective licensing. We don't have to go and do lots of deals with labels and lots of deals with publishers. We can do just one deal and get it all covered. If the whole point of collective licensing is to simplify it and reduce the number of deals, why have you stopped at two? If the whole point is to simplify it and reduce the deals, well, why can't you get your act together and have one license so that we have one organisation, one form to fill out, one invoice to pay? And actually, government agrees on that. When the government was last sort of reviewing the way licensing and particularly collective licensing works, they were sympathetic with the licensees, sort of saying what you're saying, which is, well, for starters, people are very confused. They don't know there are two licenses. PRS is much more, or traditionally was much more prolific and had a much higher profile. PPL in more recent years has also been quite prolific. But there are a lot of people who have a PRS license but not a PPL license. And then suddenly PPL rock up. And as you say, they, what are you talking about? I've got my license.
I paid it.
Yeah. And the government did say to the music industry, you should be making this even simpler. Why can't you do one license? And actually, the counterparts of PRS and PPL in New Zealand, so the collecting societies for the New Zealand music industry, did exactly that about 3 years ago. They launched this initiative called One Music. And behind the scenes, there are still separate collecting societies. So labels and artists have their collecting societies and publishers and songwriters. So it's still separate as far as the rights owners are concerned. And there's all sorts of historic contract legacy reasons why that's quite hard to overcome. However, to the customer, so actually in New Zealand, it's pretty much all the customers. Whereas I think over here, I'm not sure it's going to apply to radio in the UK. It will be cafes and bars and restaurants. But to the customer, I don't have to worry about the fact that there's this split and the money's getting divvied up and all of that. I just go to one place, I get one license, and it's all easy.
Yeah, because people don't need to know that. It's like, I mean, if you've ever tried to, so I'm sure you have, tried to explain to someone who has no knowledge of the music industry that, oh, well, you know, there's record labels and then there's publishing and it's all separately. So one owns the songs and one owns the recordings. The one who owns the recording has to pay the one who owns the songs, and they're both separate and they have different collecting sites. No, they don't need to know that, because no amount of explaining is going to make people understand that, which is why people always, if you're looking to blame someone in the music industry for something, people always go for the record label, regardless of who it is. And if you say, oh, actually, that was the publisher, they'll go, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, who's the
bloody record labels?
Although they've probably heard of PRS, so they're not going to blame a publisher, but they might blame PRS.
I bet they would still say bloody record labels and their PRS.
Bloody, yeah, they probably would. Now, PRS and PPL, seeing what's happening in New Zealand, under pressure from government, have actually been piloting this stuff before. So there are already a handful of licenses, usually for not-for-profits and charities, where you can get one PPL PRS license. And the announcement this week was that that is going to be really ramped up. So come 2017, it's going to take about a year to get this sorted. The plan is to launch a standalone entity that will have its own name.
So I won't have to say PRS PPL in intros to the podcast.
Well, unless the name is, what would it be? PPLRS for music. I don't know. Anyway, they're going to have...
They could put MCPS back in.
They could. And put Alliance at the end. Just to make it as long a name as possible. So there will be one entity that will be co-owned by PPL and PRS. And then certainly public performance, so cafes, bars, etc., can then go to one website, one form, one invoice. And then the money will then be divvied up. And some will go to PRS and some will go to PPL and some... And all it. Look, behind the scenes, it will still remain quite complicated. But to the customer, it will be a lot simpler. And on one level, well, about time too. This seems like such an obvious thing to do. Is how did it take them this long? That said, there'll be reasons why it is more complicated in the UK than elsewhere. And the UK societies are sort of leading with this, other than New Zealand, who were the pioneers. But in terms of big markets, it is quite interesting that PPL and PRS are working on this. And the two societies have been quite close to each other for a few years now, whereas in some other countries, they're very much separate and apart. So it is definitely a good development. It will be interesting to see how it works out and what name they go with. Any suggestions, Andy Maltz, beyond PPLSRSSSS for Music Alliance?
You reeled off a load of things. I quite like One Invoice.
One Invoice. So New Zealand have one music. We'll get down to what it's really about. One Invoice.
You could just call it give us cash.
One VAT receipt.
Yeah. Just money. Money for things you don't understand. What's the abbreviation of that? MFTYDU.
I will get a logo designed this weekend.
Convention dictates that we apparently still have time to talk about some of the things we didn't have time to talk about this week. One of those things is a US government task force which is making proposals that could reduce mega damages in copyright cases.
Yes, so this was a review of certain elements of US copyright law, and the one in which they proposed some changes was the way that damages work in copyright infringement cases. They're not actually proposing a change to the rules or the system, just more guidance for judges and especially juries.
Yes, because they do have a tendency to go, oh yeah, top level of damages.
Yeah, this housewife of limited means who downloaded a few tracks, $40 million. So the consensus is that although in theory the top possible amount of damages that could be awarded in a copyright infringement case won't be changed, the guidelines will make the damages that are awarded a little bit more realistic and sensible, perhaps. Although the National Music Publishers Association in the US did express some concern over this proposal. But anyway, it's just a proposal for the time being. Remains to be seen if it happens.
Because everyone loves a task force, here's another one. The Musicians Union has formed one to do a consultation on US visa issues for British artists.
Yeah, any UK artists who try and tour in the US will know that getting your visas sorted is A, tedious, and B, expensive. And it's easier the other way around. It's a lot easier for US artists to come here than it is for UK artists to go there. And this is an issue that's been rumbling around the industry for a few years now. And the MU are starting to lobby on it. And they are consulting the industry at large to basically get more ammunition to go to government, to then go to the US government and say, sort this out. So good luck to the MU on that.
Good luck indeed. On this podcast, several times now, we have spoken positively about Amazon's music streaming service and how it's sort of pioneering a move into the more mid-level services that are currently missing.
And reaching a bigger audience by bundling music in with other services, which seems like sensible for that part of the market, which is a big part of the market, where it'll be really hard to sell a standalone £10 a month music service. So well done, Amazon, with Amazon Prime Music.
But Amazon is now looking like a massive idiot because it's apparently planning to launch a standalone streaming service to compete with the likes of Spotify and Apple Music. Oh.
So that's the rumour going around this week. Let's see if Amazon go through with that threat.
Gamer,
the German PRS,
has had a bit of a knockback in its long-running YouTube litigation.
It has. This is all to do with safe harbours. It's very long. It's very complicated. If you want to know more, come to the CMU Insights Masterclass at the London HQ of Lewis Silkin next Wednesday. That's the 10th of February from 2 to 5.30pm. Tickets are just £99 from cmuinsights.com, and I'll tell you more.
Yeah, what you've done there sounded a bit like a plug. We don't really do that.
You're not endorsing my
I'm not endorsing it. And
I think you should.
Adele is not endorsing Donald Trump.
Well, I think she should. I think everybody should endorse everybody.
Right, that's not a system that can work.
So Donald Trump has been using Adele records at his things. What do they call them? His
rallies
is the word. Adele records have been used. Adele's fans noted this and said, "Why is Donald Trump using Adele records?" And so Adele's people put out the customary statement
saying, "Oh, Adele hasn't given permission for this," which was followed by 1,000 headlines saying, "Adele has not given permission to Donald Trump. He is using her music illegally," which is not the case. He is using her music perfectly legally.
Because he doesn't need her permission.
Because of collective licensing.
Yeah.
Hooray for collective licensing.
So Adele is allowed to tell Spotify that they can't use her music, she's not allowed to tell Donald Trump.
Do you know what got a lot less coverage?
What got less coverage?
Bernie Sanders used David Bowie's Starman in his campaign rally. And that's what he finishes on.
Is it?
Yeah.
And was that controversial?
No, no one cares.
And certainly David Bowie hasn't complained about it,
no,
as far as I've heard
nothing
this week.
Out of him.
So that's all fine.
Anyway, you can read all of those stories by going to completemusicupdate.com/podcast and the show notes for this podcast, and then you'll find the links in there. I'm sure I could have said that in a shorter sentence.
Should we talk about Rita Ora and Roc Nation?
No. Oh, all right then. Go on.
So Rita Ora and Roc Nation have been having a bit of a legal squabble of late.
She
signed to them.
Yes.
Roc Nation, Jay-Z's company, of course.
She signed to Roc Nation in 2008.
And she launched legal proceedings last year demanding that she be released from her contract, which apparently is a five-album contract.
Five-album contract.
And she's done one.
She's done one. She released her debut album in 2012.
And there have been no albums since. And at the heart of this legal squabble is a dispute over whose fault it is that there has been no second album. And Rita saying, "It's Roc Nation's fault. I want to be cut free of this contract and do my own thing." And Roc Nation saying, "Yeah, the problem here is that Rita Ora won't make this bloody album."
Well, it's a confusing situation, isn't it? Because she says she's made multiple albums for Roc Nation, which have gotten nowhere.
And also partly blaming that all the people she liked who worked at Roc Nation have now left.
Yeah.
And when she goes in there, no one seems to know who she is.
Also, when her album was released in 2012, it was distributed through Sony because that was Roc Nation's deal at the time. However, Roc Nation has subsequently moved to Universal.
But not with Rita.
She's still stuck with Sony. And when Roc Nation doesn't really have a relationship with Sony anymore, that's made things complicated. And she's saying all this is stalling her career. It's all a terrible thing, and she would like to be cut free. She's using the classic 7-year rule in California.
Yeah, so this is unique. I mean, normally with record contracts, the contract is locked to a number of albums. So once the deal is done, the artist has to deliver a certain number of albums to the label. It's normally a one-way commitment. So the label only has to release one album, but has the exclusive option on a certain number of albums. But there is a bit of Californian law, which sometimes applies and sometimes doesn't. That's where it gets ambiguous.
Well, it's a law that says that there's a 7-year limit on the length of personal services contracts. It was at first used in the entertainment industry in a film contract dispute when actors were contracted to studios as artists are contracted to record labels.
But I suppose the big debate always is, well, what's a personal services contract?
Exactly.
Is a record contract a personal services contract?
And that's why sometimes people win these cases and sometimes they don't.
So this was Rita's lawsuit, but this isn't news. I don't even know why we're talking about it.
It happened in December.
That happened a long time ago.
What's happened this week is that Roc Nation has countersued. And in doing so, has given us some helpful nuggets of information.
Well, an alternative viewpoint on this dispute.
Yes. Roc Nation says, "Oh, it would love to release a Rita Ora album if she would just get on and make one." And it has currently spent $2.3 million trying to get her to make one.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. What have they spent it on?
I don't know. Probably all sits somewhere in the middle. That's what these things usually turn out to be, doesn't it? So maybe Rita Ora has made several different albums.
And that's what's cost $2.3 million.
That's what's cost that amount of money. However, Roc Nation hasn't liked any of them because maybe they're not any good. And that's the problem. But Roc Nation stopped short of saying, yeah, she's just turned in a load of absolute rubbish.
So Roc Nation are looking for their $2.3 million back.
Plus
damages.
Damages for the four albums that it's not getting out of this contract if it's terminated.
But if you are thinking, poor old Rita, that's a big bill pending. Don't worry, because the word has it that despite this quite bitchy lawsuit that was filed this week, actually Roc Nation and Rita are on good terms again. Jay-Z put in a call and everyone's happy again.
It's all fine. Because, yeah, it does, you know, it's one of those things where it looks like you might get a really good, juicy court case out of it. But Rita Ora's lawyer's already like, nah, mate. It's all fine. It's all in hand.
The CMU podcast catchphrase, this will be really good if it gets to court, but it probably won't.
Well, it's already been, that's been preempted by Rita Ora's lawyer, who is Howard E. King. And he said this week that we've basically pretty much completed the settlement negotiations. It just needs to be approved by Sony Music. The only reason that Roc Nation has filed a lawsuit in return is that there was a deadline it had to respond to Rita Ora's lawsuit. So it did that by expensively drafting its own lawsuit.
An unnecessarily bitchy lawsuit.
Yes, yeah.
So,
but it's all fine.
Assuming
don't
that's
worry.
Correct, there should be a settlement announcement at some point. Whether that means, I assume it will be that she gets cut free from Roc Nation in some way.
I think that is the
sort
plan.
Of what he was implying, wasn't it? Or will it be that they re-energise the deal or whatever? So, nevertheless, even if we're not going to get the full-on case, some quite fun lawsuits that have been filed so far, and particularly Roc Nation's countersuit this week.
Yes, and that is all we have time for this week. How much would you spend on Rita Ora's second album? Why don't you let us know at CMU on Twitter? And if you happen to be on our podcast page in the iTunes store at the moment, or, you know, in the podcast app on your iPhone, why don't you just quickly rate us 5 stars? That would be real nice. Thanks.
Someone mentioned to me this week, they were telling me they enjoyed the CMU podcast, and then they apologised for not rating it because you go on about it so much.
Look, I don't like saying this any more than you like listening to it, because, you know, it feels so needy.
There are some stars in the app and you just click
you
on
just
the,
have to click. Look, if you all the, if everyone does it, I won't say it anymore. I'd happily stop.
It's such a teacher sort of thing to say. So like, you need to click on the on the far
you're
right
wasting
star.
Everyone's time.
Yeah, you're wasting my time. I've got a meeting to go to. So do the bit at the end.
Well,
stop banging on about star ratings.
Just do it. Please.
Just like platinum discs, they're basically pointless.
It is pointless, sort of, but actually it does have some effect on where we sit in the iTunes store. So do please get on it. I'm just, if you all do it, I won't say it next week.
This podcast is presented by me, Andy Malt, and him, Chris Cook. Something like that. That's how you normally finish it.
It is. I was just pointing out that they really should go and rate the podcast. Just, I can't stress that enough.
Yeah. I'm quite bored of this.
Yeah, but if I keep doing this, I'm doing the Stuart Lee thing. It'll get funny. Yeah. Anyway, star ratings. Just, you know, it's just, it's good. It's all I'm saying.
Produced by Matt Petey.
And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Doesn't matter. No one's listening.